Good morning. I'm Kathleen Shea on behalf of JD. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you. We are here today asking this court to follow its prior decisions in Chorney and Kirby and reverse the order involuntarily committing JD for 14 days. As this court determined in Chorney, at a 14-day involuntary commitment proceeding, due process requires the state to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the individual the state seeks to commit has not volunteered in good faith for appropriate treatment. A critical factor in this examination, or the critical factor really, is whether the individual has a recent history of compliance with the prescribed treatment. For example, in Chorney, the individual in that case regularly presented for treatment voluntarily, but in the incident at issue, which they were examining in that case, once he was voluntarily detained, he became very hostile. He had to be placed in restraints. He insisted on leaving and returning to outpatient treatment. In contrast,
is it voluntarily committing yourself for treatment if you say that you'll stay at the hospital, but only if it's at the hospital of your choosing, and only after you've had an opportunity to check into your apartment, visit your son, and take care of some other issues? Is that
yes,
like somebody who's going to voluntarily submit to treatment?
Yes, Your Honor. That is someone who is voluntarily submitting to treatment. Of course, that is where the trial court got hung up in this case. That's the distinction that it drew, determining that it wasn't voluntary treatment because JD was unwilling to adopt exactly the treatment plan the state wanted to impose upon her. But that is not what
it is. You have to get.
So I think you have to get as close as Chorney says, which is that you have to demonstrate that you have this willingness to actually participate in treatment. And I think that's the difference. JD, I think voluntariness.
So she was willing to do it, but at some point later after she had taken care of something.
Well, I don't think that's true, actually. I think the record very fairly demonstrates that JD was always willing to go to inpatient treatment. She went to her primary care physician, and she told him, I'm having all of these problems. I am concerned. And when he suggested inpatient treatment, she was not resistant to that. And then when the medical professional showed up at her house, or the mental health professional showed up, she talked to them, and she explained the problems she was having, and she also indicated a willingness to go to inpatient treatment if a bed was available. And I think that's sort of the problem here. The record does not discuss this, and it's hard to know exactly what's happening here. But it is interesting that here we have this fact pattern where we have a woman who is continually saying, I will go to inpatient treatment, and there's no bed that can be found for her. And then when we bring in someone who is the state, and they're involuntarily committing her, all of a sudden a bed is available. So here is a woman who's been trying to get into treatment and can't until the power of the state is wielded against her, and then all of a sudden a bed is available. Obviously that's all we have from the record, but from a policy standpoint, I think that's certainly something that this court should be concerned about, that we have individuals who are willing and ready to go into treatment, and they don't, for whatever reason, in this case, JD did not have a bed available to her until it became involuntary. And she was willing to do that at every step, but no one could help her. And so the only thing that could be done was then to provide her, apparently, it appears from the record, is with this involuntary bed. And JD saying, that's not what I want to do. I do not want to stay at Fairfax Behavioral Health. I want to go back to Swedish, where I felt more comfortable. And I want to, very reasonably, check on my son and my apartment. That is voluntary. That is her voluntarily participating in inpatient treatment. She's not saying, I want to go to outpatient treatment, or I don't want to do this at all. She's simply saying, I want inpatient treatment. But yes, to some degree, I want it on my terms.
What would your position be if the state presented evidence that the only facility that could provide inpatient treatment within the next 3 months was Fairfax, and she said, no, I'm going to wait till Swedish makes a vet available.
So I think that that is an excellent point, because that is exactly what is missing from this record. The burden is on the state, and the state here made no showing that this was the only
vet. Question, though?
So my answer to your question is that I believe would be a very different circumstance.
Would that be a person who was sufficiently noncompliant to warrant involuntary treatment?
You know, I think that her willingness to engage in voluntary treatment, her willingness to present at a hospital would mean that the state had not satisfied its burden.
No matter how long it might be until that hospital of choice could provide treatment?
Well, I guess, first of all, these are not the facts of this case. But separate from that,
you know, we have to write an opinion that has some rules for people.
Right, and I understand.
To get some information from you to help us figure that out.
Right, and of course, but I guess
to answer the questions.
My concern in answer to your question is that although that is a very long period of time, the issue would then become. That we sort of then have this failed system where no one can then present for voluntary treatment. I mean, that's my answer to that question, because that is my concern. You're saying, well, 3 months sounds awfully unreasonable, right? This person needs inpatient treatment, and they're saying, I will not go to the only one that is available, this involuntary bed. But that's a result of a larger systemic issue. That is not an individual saying, I'm unwilling to engage in treatment. She remains very willing to engage in treatment, even in that hypothetical. It's just that our system then is failing these individuals and cannot get them into the treatment they need. And that is my concern. And I'm sorry, I did want to draw that distinction, because that is not the record we have in front of us. The state, in attempting to meet its burden here, did not present that evidence. And while I certainly appreciate the hypothetical, I do think it's very important that the court consider the fact that here the state knew it had this burden, this defense had been raised, and it chose to present no evidence as to what other beds might be available or whether even Fairfax Hospital or Behavioral Health could accept her as a voluntary patient.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Alexandra Letts, and I represent the state in this case. Although in the ITA world, I represent the hospital, the petitioner in this case. The decision of the Superior Court was correct in denying Ms. Driver's good faith voluntary defense, and the petitioner asked this court to affirm Judge Schubert's ruling and find that he did not abuse his discretion. Jacqueline Driver is arguing that she had volunteered for the appropriate treatment. She went to her primary care physician. She made some statements. He offered her a voluntary bed. She said okay. The record is not clear how long she stayed and was actually willing to participate in that voluntary treatment, or whether she was actually willing to stay at all for a voluntary bed.
Doesn't the record show that she spent a number of hours waiting for the doctor to
Your Honor,
say whether or not he could find a bed for her?
I'm glad that you brought that up, because the record did not reflect that at all. In fact, in the appellant's brief, they indicated because she did not know if her insurance would cover, despite the fact that it was physically very painful to sit in the doctor's waiting room, she waited for hours to see if he could locate an inpatient bed. Finally, when his office was closing, she went home. And in appellant's reply brief, they indicated she did not leave her doctor's office until closing time, when it was clear no bed could be located that day. The actual record with that citation indicates, okay, and so Dr. Kapp offered you an inpatient bed, is that right? Yes. And you didn't, what happened with that? Answer, I waited, you know, and he was looking for a bed, and I waited and I waited and I waited, and you know, I cannot sit for hours and hours and hours. I have terrible pain. And that means I lay for 2 days. Uh-huh. Answer, which I didn't want to do, and he told me he couldn't find a bed. Uh-huh. Answer, so I said, okay, what do you want me to do? Sleep in his office? That's all the record bears. We also know from the court papers, Dr. Kapp submitted a declaration to the DMHPs for the filing of the initial petition, and in his declaration he indicated She's ambivalent about voluntary admission. Given her recent suicide attempt and continued concrete suicidal ideation, I dream her an inpatient threat to, an imminent threat to self, and request assessment from the CDMHP to evaluate her for ITA. She refused to stay in the clinic or be evaluated in the emergency department. This is an important distinction because this case can be separated. We need to look at cases on a timeline. And this case can be separated into four distinct events. The first event is that Jacqueline Driver went to see Dr. Kapp, an outpatient provider. When it comes to forcing inpatient hospitalization on someone, Dr. Kapp actually has no more authority to force that than you or I or a loved one or a family friend or someone. He can do one of two things. He can ask the patient to do what he's asking her to do and what he's recommending her to do. In this case, he offered her an inpatient bed based on the things that she told him. He was very concerned. Plus, we have the very recent suicide attempt. And second, he can call somebody for help. He can call 911. He can call the crisis clinic. But he himself cannot force a patient to complete inpatient hospitalization. Voluntary or involuntary, he can't do it. What triggers the statute, however, was the fact that Dr. Kapp called the DMHPs. So the statute, the first statute that was triggered is RCW 7105150. That is what gives the DMHPs the authority to go out and evaluate a patient, in this case in the community. What I'd also like to point out is that the record shows that the DMHPs arrived at Ms. Driver's apartment, saw her walking to them, and then she walked away from them. So I would again point out the fact that clearly if Ms. Driver spent hours and hours in Dr. Kapp's office by her own admission, if she were to sit for hours, she would have to lay for 2 days afterwards. It's unlikely that that actually occurred. Nevertheless, RCW 7105 section 150 indicates this is what allows a DMHP to go and evaluate a patient. And this is where the first good faith voluntary out of four analyses of good faith voluntary in this case took place. It says, when a designated mental health professional receives information alleging that a person is a result of a mental disorder, presents a likelihood of serious harm, the designated mental health professional may, after investigation and evaluation of the specific facts alleged and of the reliability and credibility of any person providing information to initiate detention, and that's again Dr. Kapp in this case, if satisfied that the allegations are true and that the person will not voluntarily seek appropriate treatment, the DMHP may file a petition for initial detention, which occurred here. Also, the DMHP is required to analyze whether or not the patient is a good faith voluntary patient. It says in Section B of the statute, before filing the petition, the designated mental health professional must personally interview the person, unless the person refuses an interview, and determine whether the person will voluntarily receive appropriate evaluation and treatment at an evaluation and treatment facility, crisis stabilization unit, or triage facility. The evidence showed that Ms. Witter did engage in an evaluation of Ms. Driver in this case. The DMHP's name is Ms. Witter. And she declared and she found she was not comfortable with Ms. Driver continuing with the outpatient treatment, the plan that she had articulated, because she was tearful. She indicated she didn't think that an outpatient therapist, what would that person be able to do for her? She admitted she had not been taking the medications Dr. Kapp prescribed, in fact, that she had flushed them down the toilet, was silent on whether she would be willing to take medication from another doctor. So the DMHP in this case detained her. Ms. Driver was then taken to the hospital, and the second good faith voluntary analysis in this case occurred. The findings of fact and conclusions of law and the order for detention in this case, as signed by Judge Rogers, and this is in clerk papers pages 7 through 9, and specifically page number 8, finding of fact and conclusion of law 1.2 states, no voluntary treatment. The respondent has refused, failed to accept, or has not been accepted for appropriate evaluation and treatment voluntarily.
Is that a box checked, or is that a...
It is a standard form. It is a standard form. It's not necessarily a box check, but it is articulated out. It's written out, essentially, and signed by the judge. And the court, the packet for initial detention and the document that's signed by the judge, is the entire packet is reviewed, and that includes Dr. Kapp's declaration. It includes the petition for initial detention written by DMHP Witter. The third of the four good faith voluntary analyses that took place in this case was the evaluation by Dr. Thomas, who testified in this case. He evaluated her, the hospital evaluated her, and they determined that they needed to file a petition for 14 days of involuntary treatment. And that's where statute RCW 7105 section 230 begins. We have a person in the community, then they're detained by the DMHP, so the statute is triggered, section 150 of the statute is triggered. They're then kept in the hospital for a period of 72 hours for observation. And if the hospital determines that further inpatient treatment is required, they will then file a petition for 14 days of involuntary treatment. 72 hours is sort of an arbitrary number by the legislature designed for hospitals to be able to hold a person for observation. If a person comes in and is behaving in a psychotic or erratic way, but they, for example, were high on meth or drugs, they will likely clear within that time and maybe won't need mental health treatment in that case. So the hospital is the next spot that really determines or evaluates whether or not a patient requires inpatient hospitalization. In this case, Swedish Hospital is the hospital that filed the petition for initial detention on Ms. Driver.
We establish a person is not volunteered in good faith for recommended treatment. Do you have to establish there's a bed available?
A bed available for what? Voluntary treatment or involuntary treatment?
Voluntary treatment, if you're saying. The question here is, are you available for, will you submit to voluntary treatment for inpatient treatment? Don't you also have to show there's a bed available?
Well, the first step of the analysis is to determine whether or not a patient is a good faith voluntary patient. And all of the evidence indicated to Dr. Kapp, to Ms. Witter, again to Dr. Thomas, and he represents Swedish Hospital, that she wasn't a good faith voluntary patient.
But the statute requires that you advise her that she can volunteer.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. So she was advised, and as Judge Relland indicated, suppose there was no bed available after she had volunteered. Then what?
Well, Your Honor, if the hospital would have been able to find an alternate resolution for Ms. Driver in lieu of the involuntary treatment.
How do we know that from the record that we have in front of us?
We don't have that for the record in front of us because Ms. Driver failed on the first prong, which was they didn't believe that she would qualify for voluntary treatment. They didn't believe that she was...
So the record shows that they offered her voluntary treatment and she declined.
Correct. And I think that is clear throughout her entire testimony. She had a slew of things that she wanted to do instead of receive treatment, and she wanted to get out of the hospital immediately to do that laundry list of things in lieu of receive treatment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. If I could just ask
a question
yes.
for you. Mm-hmm. Is this case moot?
No. I don't believe it's moot.
Why not?
Well, because as this court has found in the past, involuntary treatment actions have collateral consequences for individuals. So this having been committed once before will impact.
So there's a stigma attached to this finding, or it has some bearing if she were to be the subject of a future proceeding?
Right, correct. And that is why it's not moot. To address the last comment made by the state regarding a finding made by the mental health professionals about whether or not JD would voluntarily attend treatment, that was their assessment of her. That is not...
Does the record show that she was advised of the need for voluntary treatment?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's true.
And she declined.
According to them, she declined.
Well, that was the evidence before the...
That was their assessment. They believed that she was not willing to attend treatment, but that is not what the evidence in the record actually shows at the hearing. I mean, just because that is what is alleged in a petition, what matters is what is actually before the court at the evidence that is presented in the hearing. And so at the hearing, the evidence that actually came out is in fact that JD is someone that has very willingly participated in treatment, allowed these people into her home, and expressed simply her concern that perhaps a bed could not be found.
Well, you'll concede there were a number of other factors that were troubling, though. I mean, she had flushed her prescribed medications down the toilet. The last time she was released, she had agreed to arrange for outpatient treatment, which she did not follow through on.
Well, she did attempt to follow through on, and that was part of the state's argument, that she didn't have the insurance to do it, so the solution is to involuntarily commit her against her will because she doesn't have insurance. So, yes, they used that against her, but she attempted to get outpatient treatment. And I do not think that this court can distinguish from Kirby the idea that simply because she is flushing her medication, she has a plan to jump off the balcony, all of the evidence that the state is attempting to use against her, Kirby, this court has very clearly said in Kirby, goes to whether or not the individual is ill. And there is no dispute here that J.D. was suffering from depression. We are not discussing the mental order, but it does not disorder.
Flushing medications that you've been prescribed down the toilet cannot be taken as an indication of non-cooperation?
I think it's demonstrating the mental disorder, that she was feeling hopeless. I think that is certainly an interpretation of that, and all of the other evidence.
Is that the only interpretation the trial court would be permitted to make?
Well, I think that given the overwhelming evidence here that J.D. was voluntarily participating, including, most importantly, where this case is like Kirby and different than Chorney, is that when she was involuntarily committed against her will and did not wish to attend Fairfax Behavioral Health, she continued to participate in the treatment, take her medications, even take them before court. So all of that evidence must be considered when you're thinking about one incidence of flushing her medication.
Thank you.
Thank you.